You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. Today we are talking about one of the most difficult and vexing problems in America and the world, political polarization. We've seen this in the 2016 election, the Brexit vote, President Duterte's time in office in the Philippines, and in many other countries. To speak about what political polarization means and what, if anything, can be done about it, I'm joined by Professor Murat Sommer. Murat is professor of political science and international relations at Koç University. Did I say that right?
That's very good.
Okay, yeah. In Istanbul, Turkey, and presently a visiting scholar here at Stanford University. His book on the Turkish and Kurdish question won the Sadat Samavi Social Sciences Prize in 2015, and he recently co-edited two special journal volumes on polarization, democracy, and democratic erosion in the American Academy of Political and Social Science and in the American Behavioral Scientist. Murat, thank you for joining us today on World Class.
Thank you for inviting. Pleasure to be here.
So this is a huge, hard subject. I'm glad you're going to help us digest it. Let's just start with some basics. What is political polarization and what are the causes of it?
Well, I would say polarization, and of course it is possible to talk about it in technical terms, but to put it simply, it is really a division of a society, of a people, into us versus them, who begin to see each other in zero-sum oppositional terms. That's really what we call polarization. And what triggers it on the surface, of course, in each specific country context, there may be different reasons or what may seem to be very different reasons. But it is really deeply political. What we see very frequently in the world nowadays is that it's a specific type of politics that really triggers it. And it has, we can identify several, maybe two versions vaguely. One is more inclusive in the sense of its political aims, in the sense of bringing to power or including more certain groups in society that were either objectively marginalized, excluded in the past, or subjectively who perceive themselves as such. Usually there's a discussion about that in each society, of course. It's not
okay,
black and white.
And we can distinguish between the two in a social scientific way, or is that hard to do?
In terms of the political discourse of these movements,
right.
What they say they are trying to do, and then the makeup of their the composition of these political parties or movements, we can identify. A second version is more exclusionary, aims to represent groups that used to see themselves as the dominant group in society, but for one reason or another, who feel that they have been left behind or who are threatened, their dominant position is really threatened, therefore tries to exclude certain groups from political system or social and economic system. So what this politics does, however, is that it really then tries to simplify politics. It simplifies the political spectrum in terms of this them, which is the really source of the problems that this group is facing. In that sense, it really does two things. This simplification of politics really helps to consolidate the in-group, this movement itself, because these movements are in themselves very diverse. They may have also different interests and diversity within themselves. But this simplification of politics and the problem, the target group, really helps to consolidate the other group. And perhaps more interestingly and puzzlingly, it also, by simplifying politics that way, it paralyzes the other group, because the other group is often put in a very difficult place and doesn't know how to respond to this, and willingly or unwillingly, by responding, by the way it responds to this polarizing politics, it ends up deepening that polarization, which also leads to democratic decay more often than not.
Well, let's get to the decay part in a moment, but help me understand, where are the cleavages between in-groups and out-groups? Is it ethnic terms, or is it economic terms, or is it on a rural-urban divide? And I'm guessing that in different countries, it might be on different dimensions.
Absolutely. Of course, it changes from society to society. In every society, there are certain important deep-cutting cleavages that we call, in my joint work with Jennifer McCoy from Georgia State, we call that actually formative rifts.
Formative
rifts. So these are recurring issues in a nation state's history, because these are certain tensions that were created during the foundation of the state. To give you an example, in Bangladesh, the war that led to the independence of Bangladesh as a nation state, there was a division between groups who wanted to be actually part of the Pakistan and those who wanted to be secede. And from the very beginning, there was this discussion about who were the villains and who were the heroes of the national war and who was responsible for what. And this actually is a deep-cutting cleavage. However, these formative rifts, and in the case of United States, for example, as we all know, there are certain issues like race is a recurring theme, even though over time, of course, there has been a lot of progress, but it's a recurring theme because it was at the very beginning of the foundation of the United States. These formative rifts, however, do not automatically really give rise to polarization, because politics has always some degree of polarization, but sometimes polarization really increases, escalates to a degree that we call actual pernicious polarization, which then becomes really dangerous for democracy. How this happens is that the polarizing transformative politics that we call, it really may pick on one of these formative rifts. It doesn't have to, but it may pick on one of these formative rifts, or it may reinvent a different kind of cleavage. It may be economic or cultural. By doing so, it really consolidates the in-group, because society is complex, politics is complex. Mm-hmm. People may have, there may be one cleavage. You may be on the left, you may be on the right. You may have different position vis-a-vis immigration, for example.
Right.
But on the other hand, you share other things. You share neighborhood, you may share gender, hobbies, or you may support the same football team, things like that. Mm-hmm. These are cross-cutting cleavages. What polarizing politics does is to tell to the in-group that these cross-cutting cleavages do not matter or do not matter as much. But one important overriding interest or cleavage is the most important for the interests of that group. And they have to really mobilize in order to defend that interest vis-a-vis the other group who are really the source of the problem. And by doing so, of course, then over time, these other cross-cutting cleavages may really lose their importance. And this one cleavage that the movement, polarizing politics, capitalizes on overrides everything
else.
All
the rest.
And then people begin to see each other as us versus them.
I see. Well, let's apply that analytic architecture you just outlined to what's happening here in the United States for a moment. So do you see our current moment as a time of increased polarization in politics with the election of Donald Trump?
Definitely. Well, in the case in the U.S., I think polarization has been a subject that people talked about and felt for a long time since the 1970s.
Oh, so not just with Trump.
Not just with Trump.
Okay.
However, we also, I think everybody, a lot of people realize that with Trump, it has been taken to a whole new level. So we may ask, actually, why?
Yes, I think, let's ask why. It's a great question.
Yes. So I think several things that I think is related, of course, one to the discourse of the politics, and especially also the discourse that President Trump has been using, which is remarkably similar to other cases of polarizing politics in other countries, such as Turkey, Thailand, Venezuela, and so many. The parallels are really interesting. Polarizing politics is very disruptive because it defines politics as being in an abnormal, exceptional state. Something is deeply not working. And in the case of the populist version, this is usually the mainstream institutions and the mainstream elites. In the case of U.S., the elites in Washington or the economic elites. And they are really not working. There is a fundamental problem. If you define politics that way, first of all, it is really very disruptive because you're defining the very institutions and the very elites who are responsible for making sure that the system will work normally and that will serve everybody as kind of like the enemy or the source of the problem. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're defining it as a barrier. Right. It is really they are a barrier before improvement and progress and development. In which case, you're kind of also telling that extraordinary political measures or extraordinary policies and actions would be justified, right? So if you're dealing with this kind of situation, it kind of tells people that they can endorse or they should endorse kind of political tactics, discourses that vilifies the others, that vilifies institutions, that confronts them in a really almost like in a battle, that becomes actually justified. And in that sense, we see that President Trump is really using this kind of discourse and this kind of behavior. So even though the American politics and society have been polarized for a long time, the fact that within the Republican Party, and as you know very well, of course, Trump's candidacy was also created a lot of struggle and uproar within the Republican Party.
Right.
The fact that he became actually the Republican candidate for the presidency is very important because...
What if he had failed? Would we be so focused on polarization? Like, what if Jeb Bush had won? Would we be having this conversation?
As long as the opposition, and the American society as a whole doesn't really understand, look at causes of this polarization, perhaps this level of polarization would have been postponed.
Okay.
But it could have come, not forgotten. It could have come perhaps later,
right.
But it would.
So here's the other paradox. Just, I'm not an expert on American politics, but I follow them closely. And I worked for the previous president for 5 years. And what's striking to me is before Trump, the American people elected an African-American with a pretty funky name, by the way, twice. And he did well in some states that then the swing voters then voted for Trump in 2016. So, you know, in the three states that were pivotal to Trump's victory, President Obama carried them all. And even in my home state, which is considered a very conservative state, Montana, I think President Obama got 46-47% of the vote. So he didn't win the state, but he came very close. That suggests to me that maybe the voters aren't as polarized as our politicians, but it's a paradox. So help me understand the paradox. How could we have gone from this fairly moderate person in the Democratic Party, and then he loses votes to a candidate who seems almost entirely different from him? And it's those switching of those voters that makes Trump president.
Well, when Obama was elected, his motto was, yes, we can.
Right.
In a way, he also promised a kind of transformative politics.
Okay. So right? He himself back then was already pushing against the status quo.
Pushing against the status quo. Uh-huh. However, as a politician, of course, ideologically, he did not use the kind of populist and other vilifying kind of discord language that Trump, President Trump is using.
Right.
And of course, ideologically, these two presidents are very, very different.
Right.
But rather than asking the question, are voters as polarized as the elites are or vice versa? Perhaps we should ask the question, why are some voters, a significant segment of the American voters, are receptive or potentially open to this kind of polarizing politics?
That's a better question.
And this maybe that, you know, that there is some expectation of fundamental change.
Right.
So that is this. And here is the question is, of course, what kind of politics will respond to this need for fundamental change?
Right.
So it may be, of course, we hope, and I think this is very important, that a politics with a democratizing agenda committed to democracy will respond to this need.
Right.
But if this kind of politics fails to respond to or meet that demand, that need, then polarizing transformative politics and frequent version of that is populist, but there are many other versions of it, will actually respond to this demand.
And be a breakdown of democracy.
And eventually, in many cases, we have seen
change
that.
Change the institutions. Well, let's pivot in that vein to talk about Turkey. Explain to our listeners, who I'm sure most of them don't know much about politics in general in Turkey, let alone polarization. But do you see similar patterns there as in the United States, or is there a different sources of polarization?
On one hand, of course, on the surface, if you look at Turkey and the United States, they are two very different countries, very different polities. Turkey is a very old society, polity, heir to the Ottoman Empire, and is between Middle East and Europe, in the center of Eurasia, and is an upper middle income country, still a developing country, but also an emerging, rising economy. So United States is, of course, quite different. But that is actually really the interesting issue about polarizing, come transformative politics. In every society, when they are confronted by this situation, people tend to think that the reasons are unique to themselves. And they may either say that actually we are immune to democratic breakdown that results from polarization.
Right.
For example, American exceptionalism.
Right.
Or they may think that, well, we are actually vulnerable to this. This is happening because something is wrong with our society, mm-hmm. a weakness in our society. And in this sense, both prevailed actually in Turkey as well, a kind of Turkish exceptionalism similar mm-hmm. to American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. One side of it was that Turkey was hailed as a flawed, yet a unique and promising example of democracy in a Muslim-majority country
right.
and in the Middle East. As the heir to the Ottoman Empire, it was founded as a republic in 1923. And after a period of one-party regime and a revolutionary period, secularizing revolutionary period, it also transitioned to multi-party democracy. And with many shortcomings, however, and interruptions in this competitive political experience, Turkey remained a democracy. And the idea was that certain institutions that were founded at the beginning of the republic, they were very strong. And they would not allow the kind of things that, for example, we have observed in less developed democracies or polities in the Middle East and so on.
Right.
These things would not happen in Turkey. So Turkey was accepted also with the coming to power of the Justice and Development Party in 2002, which was a party in political Islamism. In fact, many people were actually kind of hopeful that this flawed yet working democracy of Turkey would consolidate itself as a right. liberal democracy.
That's Mr. Erdogan's party, right?
Just this for is the current president, Mr. Erdogan's party.
Their first big electoral victory was 2002.
At the end of 2002,
right.
exactly.
And there was a hope that would be a good influence that they were coming into the political system, the democratic system.
Yes, two reasons for that. One, that I said these previous shortcomings of the Turkish democracy. One shortcoming was that it's is a secular democracy. Its relative exclusion of religious politics.
Right.
And that was seen as a weakness because that was an existing really politics and representing a certain segment of society in Turkey. So they came to power legitimately through elections and the system allowed it. But these institutions that I mentioned earlier that people thought would make Turkey unique, such as the judiciary, which was a pro-secular, a strong judiciary, acting partisan in an ideologically motivated way often, mm-hmm. but at the same time, however, really defending certain principles of the constitution,
right.
the military, and so on, other institutions. They were also, however, in a way preventing change because they were conservative in themselves. Now, then Prime Minister Erdogan and his party then really picked up on this. After a while, they really began to use more and more the polarizing politics. They argued that for Turkey to become a real democracy, for the relatively excluded segments of society to be included, to be empowered, mm-hmm. we need a disruptive type of politics. You're either with us or with them. And they began to use this politics more and more. And for a while, it looked like having some democratizing impact as well, because they were able to really overcome these conservative institutions in society. However, after doing this, the polarization also began to transform the Justice and Development Party itself.
Okay.
So because polarizing politics advantages a certain kind of politicians and actors in society, not necessarily people who are moderate, who really want to have reconciliation and mutual understanding and unity, and often people who are willing to use very divisive kind of discourse, often demagogues, and who do not necessarily have very strong commitment to democratic principles.
Right.
But we should here in this process, we should also include, of course, the reactions of the opposition as well.
Uh-huh.
And here we see a certain kind of similarity between Turkey and Turkey in earlier, perhaps 10 years ago, and the United States. When polarizing politics uses a disruptive politics, because it defines politics in exceptional terms, it also sees itself the right to use dubiously democratic and not really legitimate means and tactics. Now, when the opposition sees that, whether they agree with the or not disagree with the goals of the incumbent party, of course, they will disagree. But they see that the incumbent party or leader is doing things that are not really legitimate or that are not really completely legal and acceptable ways. Then they are outraged, understandably. But in terms of what will happen to this polity, in terms of democracy and polarization, everything depends on how they express their reaction, what they do in response to it. Some typical reactions from oppositions from across the world is that, first of all, to focus on the leader, because usually these polarizing politics examples are represented by a visible, salient, charismatic kind of a leader.
Right.
So who is really leading these policies? Really focusing on him or her. But that often is counterproductive because it ends up deepening the polarization. The supporters of the polarizing incumbent party and leader, they close ranks to defend their guy.
And that just leads to more conflict. Yeah.
And it further personalizes politics, which is the really
opposite of what we want to see.
The opposite of what we want to see. Another issue, a really big mistake that the oppositions make is that in order to oppose the wrongness of the policies of the incumbent party, they end up deepening polarization itself. If they think that, for example, that the incumbent party is using religion, which they may be right in opposing this, but then calling all the supporters of the incumbent movement, the incumbent party, is religious fanatics, for example.
Right.
Or in the case of the U.S., racist.
Right.
So this also really the opposite of what we want, because then, again, the consolidates the other group. Another typical reaction is that to really invoke institutions, to go to the courts, try to invite the judiciary to react and to sanction the president or the incumbent party.
Right.
But that also often politicizes the judiciary. Another reaction is that to go to the streets, protests, which may be sometimes necessary. But again, this may lead to a backlash from the supporters of the incumbent party, who may also actually begin protesting. We saw this in Thailand, for example. It also happened in Turkey. Again, it deepens the polarization. When polarization really deepens, after a while, it doesn't matter who is right.
Right.
Both sides actually really trying to support.
And it sounds like a real vicious cycle, right? Back and forth.
Yes. So we may actually ask the question then, what can be done about it? And this
We're going to have to do that very quickly. Give me that, because we've gone over time. It sounds like a deep, hard thing. Give me your top two or three ideas of what can be done.
The most important, I think, one takeaway is that the kind of politics that can successfully challenge this polarizing, transformative, authoritarian politics might be another kind of polarization.
Okay.
But a constructive kind of polarization.
Interesting.
So this, a kind of polarization, one that really doesn't capitalize on these formative rifts, because really on something else. And rather than creating an either-or choice, presenting an either-or choice to the society,
right?
Not in terms of personalities, but in terms of policies.
Okay, interesting.
And these policies need to respond to this need that we talked about at the beginning of our chat. It should really be a response and to the constructive and feasible response to this need in society for transformative change.
On that optimistic note, I think we're going to end for now, Murat. It sounds like a very hard set of issues, and maybe next time we'll come back and we'll do some deep dives into some other countries just to get detail. But it's been great to have you on World Class.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners to find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.